Okay, so first I would like to thank the organizers to have invited me to this wonderful workshop. I mean, it's been paradise since I arrived, so I really, really am grateful for that, and it's really great to meet another community as well. So this will be a review on heavy fermions, both from what a theoretician understands about the experiments. Is not the best theoretician, but it will be my review on experimental status. And as well, maybe about the failures of the theoretical approaches of condensed matter, such as we have been pursuing them so far, and also what we think might still work on that. So I'd like to acknowledge some discussions with a few collaborators. Mike Norman, Indranil Paul, Adele, Ben Lagra, and Kisok Kim, who have been my kind of interlocutors for these works along the years. And also make a little bit of advertisement for this wonderful place. Now there is a picture of the institute, which is in Brazil, called the International Institute of Physics in Natal, where I spent a year and a half ago. And it's an institute which has a vocation to, to do physics on a very large spectrum, from field theory, string theory, to condensed matter. So I really encourage you to go there for workshops and also for the conference they will be organizing in the future. And this is much less romantic. It's my institute in Saclay, in France. So we'll talk about heavy fermions. And before we start, those beasts, the heavy fermions, they are a complex system from the point of view of chemistry. So I suppose everyone knows it here, but I will just remind a little bit of chemistry facts. So you usually have a few big atoms together. Here, a big one like ytterbium, cerium, or uranium, with 5F electrons on it. And here, in this beautiful iridium atom, you will see ytterbium, sorry. It's a body-centered lattice. And in the middle of it, you will have some d electrons, some metallic atoms, which constitute a base for metal. So you see, you will have two sort of electrons. One kind, which is associated to the big 5F shells, which will have a tendency to be more localized on parts of the sides of the lattice. And on this sub-lattice here, the orbitals, I mean, they do what they can, but it's much more delocalized ones. And the shell electrons will have a tendency to delocalize themselves and share between atoms nearest neighbors. So it's all this physics between localization and delocalization, two type of fermions, and a possibility of hybridization between the two bands, of if you go to strong coupling formation of a Kondo effect or Kondo lattice. So the chemistry is as it is, so it's quite complex. Now you might wonder why at all physicists would get interested in materials, and this is an explanation I like from a friend and good collaborator, Piers Coleman. So this is his vision why England lost the War of Independence. It's because at the time the boats were made with iron balls, and they were rusting very quickly in the sea. And if they had made them of copper, it would have been much, much better for the Brits. But as a French, my vision of why the Brits lost is a little bit different. Okay, so heavy fermion metals. So for most of their lifetime since their discoveries, the heavy fermions, they have been the champions of metallic state. In a sense, this very complex structure at the level of the chemistry, when you cool down in temperature and reach very close to zero, so here you have a superconductivity transition, but forget about it. If you forget about superconductivity here, it's a bad example, It's a very good metal, so it will follow the universal laws of Landau Fermilikou theory of metals with an extremely renormalized mass. So it was really the signature of the heavy fermions of the robustness of the Fermilikou theory. Here for uranium beryllium 13, which is maybe the king of heavy fermions, you have a renormalization of the effective mass of the quasi particle, which are like these renormalized electrons, of the order of 1,000. So it's probably the best example of those metals. And you see typically how it goes for the resistivity of various compounds. So you have kind of a bump at some kind of temperature of roughly a few tenths of Kelvin. And then it kind of falls like crazy, and you have a T-square in the bottom. And this temperature, which is quite visible as a crossover, is usually called the Kondo temperature, although we know there is no real Kondo effect because it's a lattice. But experimentalists used to call it the single Kondo temperature. It's a parameter which is very useful to know when you discover one of those new beasts and you don't really know it very well. Because below this temperature, basically, most of the screening due to the lattice effect will have occurred. And you will end up with to screen basically Alog2 a little bit more on each side. But we'll come back to that a bit later. So far, the message is like very good metals. And actually, yeah, that's transitioned well. So it's complex materials and metals, so that the three atoms, big atoms, which constitute the outside lattice as cerium, ytterbium, or uranium. And you see immediately, if you make a little bit of the cone for the spin orbit interaction, that you generate big spin, big momenta. You have 5 halves for the most simple cone for the cerium, 7 halves for ytterbium, and 4 for uranium. So there's a lot of entropy on each side, huge amount of entropy. This is in the UV for us, it's 1 electron volt. And the system doesn't like it, so one will go down in temperature. We want to screen the entropy. So first, the degeneracy will be left by spin orbit coupling. So there's usually a huge spin orbit coupling in those compounds. And then the crystal field effect, so electric field generated by the crystal, will lift again degeneracy. And this switches to the order of roughly 100 Kelvin. Here, or a bit less, you see, it's a bit less than 100 Kelvin. And most of the degeneracy due to this, what we call lattice effect, has been lifted. And then we end up with what else the system wants to do. It will want to maybe Kondo screen to lift the remaining degeneracy to form some phases like antiform magnetism, superconductivity, or gain metallic. With Kondo screening, but it's a complex system in terms of chemistry. So you might have some valence fluctuations. So the valence electrons on the big atom might want to fluctuate. It can generate due to the RKKY interaction between the spins of the big atom. It can generate some ferromagnetism or antiferromagnetism. And you could have a multiple stage screening if when the lattice effects have been taken into account, your moment is still bigger than 1/2. So the spin of the electron would not be enough to screen the remaining moment and to reduce the entropy. So there are two examples here I'd like to give of the complexity. For example, this compound, cerium, copper, germanium, which is here under pressure, and you see that 1 antiferromagnetic phase and 2 superconducting temperature are generated. Here it's also very interesting. So you dope a compound of cerium with lanthanum. So lanthanum has no F electrons, so it's kind of inert. And when it's inert, so you kind of dilute your Kondo lattice with some kind of vacancy. You create disorder, of course, but when you dilute, you will reach a regime where it's more and more Kondo-like, and what we call a Kondo lattice temperature will become like a Kondo impurity temperature at large dilution.
Excuse me.
Sorry.
Sorry, could you go back to that slide?
Yeah.
the phase boundary between what you call SC1 and SC2, how is that determined? In the figure on the lower left.
That?
Yeah. Between SC1 and SC2.
Oh, I forgot. Sorry. I forgot which type it is for on this one.
I think it's heat capacity, right? They see nodes or something, don't they?
It's heat capacity, but I don't know which type of symmetry it's 1 and 2. I'm not so sure they know.
One place is gapped and one place is has nodes.
And basically here as well as a lot of resistivity for sure. Okay, so quantum criticality is supposed to appear in many compounds, and it also, I like to start with a more controversial one, which is high temperature superconductors, because indeed it's one where we know that there is a regime of T only energy scale here above, but we don't really know whether they are QCPs. Well, we know they are quantum critical points. The electromagnetic phase goes to zero here. And here, when you put a strong magnetic field, you can see also some kind of quantum critical point, but it's much more controversial. But what we know is there is a very wide regime where there seems to be a marginal Fermi liquid here, and apparently it's one phase at the ADS system, the ADS mechanism reproduces very well. But in those systems, the presence of the quantum critical points and the validity of, the robustness of their effect on the whole phase diagram is still very questionable. In heavy fermions, we are the opposite situation. So we know they are QCPs. So we know they are playing a main role here. And this is a plot that you have probably seen many times already. This component is cadmium, rhodium, silicon. And here you have the resistivity exponent as function of temperature. So it goes like T squared here, like Fermi liquid. And in the orange region, it goes like linear in T. And you see how beautiful it is. Like it has 3 decades of energy. And it doesn't stop. Here you have another example where we know we have a QCP. This one is more typical because around the quantum critical point, we have a superconducting dome, where the maximum of the dome is supposed to be pretty close to the point where the antiferromagnetic phase is going to zero. So in this compound, I'm not so sure they know there is coexistence, actually. So it's another story. Over there? Oh, it will continue roughly up to 15, I would say. Kelvin. As I showed you, there are some energy scales in the system. So one in this particular system, some energy scale at high energy on which you screen the entropy. So remember, we talk about crystal field effects, spin orbit coupling, crystal field effects. So for this system, the first crystal field effect is seen at roughly 100 Kelvin. And the 17 Kelvin is what we call the dome, the condo temperature. So below 17 Kelvin, you will have to screen R-log2, probably. So if you integrate the specific heat up to 17 Kelvin by supposing that at T equals zero you have no entropy, you will get R-log2. It's not really R-log2 because it's a real compound, but I don't remember the number, but it's the order of magnitude. Okay, so this is a table on which we have classified a few, it's not all of them, of the heavy fermions, which have been driven to a quantum critical point through an external parameter.
Where's this table from?
It's from an old paper I did with Piers Coleman in, I don't remember when. But the one you have here has been improved with time. So each time there is another compound, we put in it. This is something where we wanted to show the variety of compounds. Typically, what experimentalists do, and also it's a way of, give some credits to most of the groups in the world which are doing this tough job. And what you see, it looks a bit like the first time, my God, I mean, so many things, like all of them have some kind of barbaric names, but they have a few things in common. So what they have in common, they are all driven to a quantum critical point by external parameter. So what we call external parameter is pressure, external magnetic field, and pressure can be hydrostatic or chemical. So when it's chemical, I call it X. When it's magnetic field, H. And when it's hydrostatic, it's P, like it's equal to 0. Now, what the QCC on this table is only two quantities are reported, the specific heat Sommerfeld coefficient, C over T, gamma, and which should be a constant in Fermi liquid theory, and the resistivity exponent at very low temperature, which would go like T squared in Fermi liquid theory. So if we look, for example, at the resistivity here, we don't see T squared at all, actually. So it seems that Fermi liquid theory is broken for all of them except the two which have the question marks. So far for our beautiful heavy fermions, at the beginning I told you they are the kings of metals, and now I'm just telling you, like, look at all of those. None of them is a true metal. Yep.
So are some of these layered, and should they consider 2D and some of them
3D? No, they are all bulk. But some of them will have some anisotropy of the Fermi surface, we'll see. But when we talk about anisotropy here, it's not a factor of 1,000, or it's not like it's if it was a film or two stack layer like in the cuprate. It's more a factor of 5 to 10.
You consider this a 3D system?
Not completely. If the Fermi surface is almost cylindrical with corrugation, I would say it can have some 2D features, but the main it will be bulk for the at least for transport for sure. Now the magnetism can be extremely anisotropic in those systems, but that's system dependent. Like when now I say extremely, it can be a factor of 100 for magnetism. Magnetism is complex in those systems, really complex. But the transport will be always isotropic, mostly. So the specific heat, it's not better. So none of them is Fermi liquid. No, actually, this one and those who have this one is a little bit better actually because it has a constant. But the deviation from the constant is significantly non Fermi liquid. So you have two ways of breaking the Fermi liquid here. A strong way, which I characterize by those three compounds, ytterbium, rhodium, silicon, serum cobalt, and 5, serum cobalt, 6, gold. And maybe this one as well, I don't know why it goes there. Maybe ytterbium, silver, germanium, which could go there. And you have a weaker way of breaking the Fermi liquid theory, and for which the deviation for the specific coefficient goes up like a logarithm. So again, a logarithm is something very tough for an experimentalist, I mean, to extract. So we see it looks a bit like a logarithm on one decade of energy. It means it grew up. Most of experimentalists I talk to, they tell me they could fit by something like that, by power law. And the resistivity is much less drastic, so it will be 1.5, 3.5, this one, 1.6. So this seems to work better and to be much more in accordance with what we call a weak breakup of Fermi liquid theory. That's where we'll see, like we call Hertzsprung scenario, but I'll just review the theory in a few minutes. So, just what I was saying, there are two scenarios that we identified, like I think the community agrees. So there's a weak breakup of Fermi liquid theory. So you suppose you have a Fermi liquid background, here I call HF, heavy Fermi liquid, and you have a non-ferromagnetic typical transition at T equals zero, which creates a quantum critical point. So a T equals zero transition for us is a definition of a QCP. I mean, it will be a very pragmatic definition. And around here, the quantum fluctuation of the order parameter will create some non-analyticities and will interact with the fermion. There is a theory to describe that, the Hertzsprung theory, which predicts roughly the type of exponents we saw in the compounds which break the Fermi liquid weakly, like those here. So it will be a resistivity in 3.5 and a correction of 1.5. For the specific heat coefficient. And there is another scenario on which many theoreticians have been working on, where there is a new scale that we call ISTA, which goes to zero at some point. And still you have a phase, like on for magnetism, superconductivity. So whether you have only one QCP, so the two points are the same or not, is still very under very strong debate in the field. It's one of the questions which has absolutely not resolved. But this QCP, we call quantum breakdown or fractionalization or deconfined quantum critical point, it involves much stronger field theories, and it's what we call very strong coupling QCP, and usually the Fermi surface is hot and the Fermi surface volume change at the transition at this one, the ISTA. So the ISTA, as far as fermions are concerned, is a much more drastic perturbation than the anti-Fermi magnetism. Fermi magnetism here is supposed to be itinerant electron anti-Fermi magnetism, so it's kind of spin density wave perturbation of the Fermi surface. So, okay, in the following, I'll review the theoretical approaches for this and say it will also be a way to tell you where we need help from string theories and to describe these strong coupling effects. So, we look at universality, and what we mean is we go from the UV where everything is different into the high air, where everything looks the same. So in low energy, we capture the slow universal part, and we go from the chemistry that I started with this very complex material, to do physics and to extract what is universal in all the compounds that we are looking around. So what is universal? The Fermi liquid theory is universal. In the Landau Fermi liquid theory, so the resistivity is in T square, so that's what we were discussing. Then there is a saturation of the static spin susceptibility as function of temperature and the Sommerfeld coefficient, and some T square corrections of the Sommerfeld coefficient in an analytic version of Landau. And around some QCP, it's broken, as we just saw, and the resistivity at the most is linear in T. You can have some compounds even with some sublinear exponents. Sometimes you have an anomalous exponent for the static spin susceptibility, like in cerium, copper 6, gold. And the Sommerfeld coefficient will diverge at the quantum critical points, which will be a signature that the effective mass is getting a very strong normalization and divergence there. So the big question for a condensed matter theorist is how to integrate the fermions out of the partition function. So those fermions, if we keep them in the theories, we have real trouble to control any perturbation theory, especially close to quantum critical point. Yep.
Just going back, alpha and beta are generically different.
Is compound dependent? Compound dependence? Yeah, it seems to at least in a class where the Fermi liquid is weakly broken, like we call a Hertzsprung theory, there is some power laws which are verified for those. But in the class where it's strongly broken, so far the power laws they kind of oscillate a bit from compound to compound. They are all a very drastic deviation from Fermi liquid theory, but it we didn't succeed to extract some deep universality on those problems. The only thing universal there is like it's a deeply non-Fermi liquid. So, okay. So why do one integrate out the fermions out of the partition function? Well, first it's a natural idea because if you look at the system microscopically, you want to describe it by hydrodynamic modes or bosonic modes, which basically will couple to the microscopical physics of the system. And the fermions, they have this Fermi surface. And at first you show, we'll see that the theory break up due to the presence of these massless fermions, which are non-relativistic in two and three dimensions, especially close to itinerant electron quantum critical points. So we want to integrate desperately to integrate out the fermions out of the partition function. And at first sight, it looks easy because, the fermions, they seem to have a spectrum which goes linearly with k, and the bosons, they go like k squared, so they look fast. So first, the first side, you say, okay, this is no problem. We'll just integrate them out, and we'll get the effective right theory. And what Kuiesh program is the Fermi surface, actually. The Fermi surface has different types of scattering, the one which is perpendicular to it, which it was described here, like EK goes linearly with K, like what will a fast scattering. And those can indeed be quite easily integrated out of partition function, or they will not create many trouble in the large N expansions or perturbative treatments that we look around. What creates trouble is all the processes which are parallel to the Fermi surface here, and which can be created by very slow mode of bosonic type. I mean, two electrons. This scattering parallel to Fermi surface is really annoying, and we can see already that the curvature of Fermi surface will play a role for this reason. Okay, so from John Ernst, it was a previous paper by Bealmono and theory by Moria, and then the last paper by Andy Millis. There is what we call the standard model of quantum criticality in experience, which is the spin mass integral scenario, or we should call theory, or we call also Hertzsprung theory. So what is done in this theory is like we know we will have trouble if we integrate the fermions out of the partition functions, but we'll do it anyway. So we integrate them out formally, and then we expand the resulting expansion trace of log. We expand it to second order, and we get a wonderful effective field theory. I should have written a Lagrangian, but since it's the integration is so drastic, I'll just call it F. So which goes like the other parameter to the square and to the force, to a phi to the fourth field theory, in terms of the other parameter of the transition, so four magnetism or anti-four magnetism. So what we get is something quite simple. So there is indeed a dependence in energy. So remember, we are close to a quantum critical point. So now all the quantum criticality, so there is infinity in space, but in the time direction will be constrained by temperature. So it's as if we were working in a quantum critical system in finite geometry. So the time dimension plays the role of a finite length. I mean, time direction, sorry, inverse of time is temperature. So inverse of temperature, it's not 1 over 2, so it's 1 over T, so this is one typo. The only thing I want to say is the system is working in the... So in the time direction, it's 1 over T. And in the space direction, you can go to infinity. So you have a finite size geometry. A configuration for your system at the quantum critical point, and we define the dynamical exponent as a number of dimension of space that the time direction is taking, and this is given by doing naive scaling on the effective Lagrangian that we get. And if we get this form, we see that nu equal 2. Typically, we always get a Q square. It comes from high energy. It's no from one electron volt effect from the. So we always have some kind of Q square in the static sector. The dynamical sector is a bit more complex since it's dominated usually by Landau damping, and it's different from a ferromagnet and antiferromagnet. So for a ferromagnet, since we don't break translational invariance, we have the typical Landau damping, which goes like it should be minus 1 I omega over Q. So it's damping and it's 1 over Q. So you see that omega now goes like Q third, so Z equal 3. For the antiform magnet, you break translational invariance, and your typical ordering wave vector is pi pi or pi pi pi. So it's commensurate with the lattice, and then it will put a cutoff into this into the Landau damping, and now you get the frequency going like Q square, so Z equal 2. So you work in an effective dimension of space time, which is very big, which will be equal. I suppose your component is in D equal 3, as you are mentioning. The effective dimension is 6 for the ferromagnet and 5 for the antiferromagnet. Yes, the effective dimension is 6 for the ferromagnet and 5 for antiferromagnet. So you see that you are much above the property dimension, which is 4 for a phi 2 4 theory. So, I mean, then you end up with something trivial. Say, okay, we integrate out the fermions, they just renormalize our bosonic mode, and the theory is completely trivial. You just do mean field theory on that, and you get all the exponents. okay, let's do it. And what was done by those guys. So now we have an effective bosonic field theory. So to get the resistivity, we have to couple back to the fermions. But anyway, the coupling will be a treatable in the first orders in perturbation. And what we obtain are some class of universal exponents, which are all tabulated by the dimensionality of your compound and the dynamical exponent Z, the one we're just describing. So there is one thing, though. Is on the fermion surface, you can have electrons which are part which are hot or which are cold on the fermion surface. It's due to the fact that if you don't break translational invariance, typically the whole fermion surface is hot. If you break translational invariance like anti-four magnetism, a few electrons on the fermion surface will be able to connect from one another. So this is kind of hot and cold spot. Put a bit maybe. And this is something that we can, like a 3D spin density wave, the specific heat coefficient will go like constant minus T1/2. Resistivity will go like T3/2. So if you see the compound, the series of compounds which I was calling weakly breaking the Landau-Fermi liquid theory, they were in this universality class, the one which called the spin density wave. So what you could have also is some configuration where a big bunch of the Fermi surface is hot. How do you get that? For example, you have very, very strong anisotropy in the magnetic part. So the magnetism will be quasi two-dimensional, but the metal will be 3D. In that case, you will have an easy axis on which you could rotate. And instead of having lines on Fermi surface, actually, here it's lines, actually, it's lines of width, root of T. You would have hot regions. And in that case, the Hertzsprung theory predicts resistivity linear in T and specific heat going like T0 over T. So it's not too bad. It already does a very good job, and there's still a very hot debate whether it can describe the what happened in cerium copper 6 gold. Remember, for the anti-four magnetism, D equal 2 is the upper critical dimension. So I think that's still log T, sorry. There is a log. It's up to log. I think there is a log here. But anyway, the log will be very difficult in any case to extract from the experimentalist, from the T behavior. Many people, like the community, is divided. There are anomalous, very strong anomalous exponents in the magnetic sector for these compounds, which really call for a stronger quantum critical point. My opinion is I'm much more on the side that this is enough. So the work for this was done by Roche in 98, so you noticed that the Hertzsprung theory was working for this one.
There are hot regions and there's also cold regions.
Yeah.
What if the cold regions carry the current with a lower resistivity because they're basically fairly liquid like?
Yeah, they should actually.
So why isn't the dominant conductivity correspond to T square?
You're right, it should. You have to weight the hot region by, I mean, at least you have to have a larger, very much larger part of the fermion surface which is hot, basically almost everything. So it has to be 2D enough so that the part which is cold is negligible. You're right.
Where does the log come from? Is there a marginal?
No, it's a thermal log usually. It's not. It's thermal effect. It's usually at the upper critical dimension. You can get that for those compounds. It's coming from thermal excitation of the fermions. We have it also in D equal 3 for the ferromagnet. But. There's usually a log over there, but it's not typical of the bosonic QCP. So when you calculate resistivity, you will have a part which is fermionic, which will produce a log. Okay, so now I review the problems that we have with the theory. The problems will start to show up. So far we just integrated all the fermions, expand to second order, and calculate the exponents. The theory was simple. We were above upper critical dimension. When we were coupling back to fermions, it was doing perturbatively. And we could have access to all the quantities we wanted, basically, with Hertzsimmel's theories. So after doing Hertzsimmel's, you notice there is a few problems. And here I will summarize them with the example of the ferromagnetic QCP. Namely, we don't break the translational invariance. So you have, we start with a Hamiltonian, it could be, or here, a Lagrangian, but it could be different from that, and here we call it spin Fermion problem. So what we see, we have conduction electron going on the Fermi surface, that is denoted by EK, and you have some spin-spin correlation, which have this form in the UV, so Q square, and this is the length, and in omega, we put a term in omega square, which will be renormalized very strongly. And now we have some electrons and spin interaction, which are of magnetic type, which are ferromagnets. So now if you do this theory and you bluntly expand in perturbation theory, here I take d equal 2, but this is valid also in d equal 3, so you get some trouble. So first, I give the example, but it will be the same for the vertices. Like you take the self-energy, one loop, you would get omega 2 third. Now if you put a correction on the self-energy, you get omega 1 third. And it goes on like crazy like that. So this is when you do the most naive perturbation theory on this compound. And in 3D, you will get like the logs. Logs will pile up like that. So there is already one way to correct this, is to notice that in order, when you obtain this very strong divergence, you have linearized around the Fermi surface, so you took the fermions which were didn't take into account the curvature of Fermi surface. So curvature of Fermi surface and self-consistence helps. So now when we do what we call lineage break theory, we neglect all the vertex corrections. We see that we can do that in certain conditions. And we dress all the propagators. So we dress the propagator by their own self-energy. In that case, it's much better. Instead of having those factor of minus one third between the each time you put an interaction. So here, so far, you say, my God, it's a catastrophe. The theory is completely blowing up in your face. But then you get factors of one, so everything will be of order one if you dress the propagator with their own self energy.
First calculation, there's just no curvature in the Fermi surface.
Yeah, so if you linearize Fermi surface, the percritical dimension is 3. So below d equal 3, you are in trouble. You pile up the logs. Now, if you put the curvature, and to do the Eliasberg treatment, we need the curvature. Because then we will do a large N treatment on that. So we are prefactors to those quantities. They're all over the one now. If you dress the propagators, they're all over the one. And if you put some artificial large N, which will be proportional to the number of colors, so you take N replica of the number of fermions. And you need two small parameters, first alpha, which is this parameter here, which will go like 1 over n, and a parameter depending on the curvature. So the curvature is important and has to go like 1 over n as well. So with those two small parameters, we thought, gosh, okay, that's more or less controlled. We have dressed the propagator. We could neglect the vertices. I don't need to show it to you there. But it was not the end of the story. Then some other diagram popped up, which we call, I call at least BKV singularity, but it's Wojtek-Kirpatrick in 2003, I believe, from those. So in the static sector, here you have a very strong singularity created in d equal 2 and 3. I'm sorry, I didn't put on this what it is. So in d equal 2, you get minus mod q, and d equal 3, you get q square log q. So it will affect tremendously the phase diagram around the ferromagnet, since you have a minus sign. And basically, in most of the cases, it stabilizes the quantum critical point, and you go to a first order phase transition or spiral order. There have been very recent work, nice work by Andrew Green, don't know whether I'll talk about that, and Ben Simon, so work by Chubukov Maslov on this subject. So the ferromagnetic QCP seems to be unstable due to those. And they are beyond Eliasberg theory. And it's not the end. So the culprit for this state of affair, which is getting worse and worse, is the backscattering. So So the curvature of the Fermi surface so far, it was good for us because it was helping to regularize a little bit. If we linearize, we were in deep waters. We couldn't say anything at all. So with the curvature, we could have a Lierschberg treatment. We could have 1 over n, except that there was this problem that popped up, the Bielis-Kavarek-Voita. And now there is another thing, the backscattering. It's what is responsible here, actually, for the one before. And apparently, it is also affecting the anti-Fermi-Indic quantum critical point, the nematic, as well as the ferromagnet. So this is a recent work by Sansikli that you have heard, and by Matt here and Sergeyev. So I myself was not aware that it was affecting the anti-Fermi-Indic, and it seems to be due as well to two patches. So if you have two patches on the Fermi surface and they are almost tangential, then it will affect very strongly the Fermi surface itself, so it will deform the Fermi surface at the hot spot and create anomalous exponents affecting as well the Z exponent. And there was one question whether the universality of when the QCPs are really breaking the Fermi liquid theory, whether the exponents were universal. Apparently they are not, and this could be an explanation why, because the backscattering seems to affect the dynamical exponent itself. So backscattering, I mean, it's a property what I would call Fermiology, it's a property of Fermi surface. So I mean, backscattering for maybe I didn't define it. I mean, suppose everyone knows it. So it's one of the scattering process I was studying. You have the Fermi surface here. So you have scattering process which are forward scattering between two electrons, and some which will put the electron back. But you see, between an electron here and there, you could have a tangential Fermi surface with a point where they become tangent and close to a quantum critical point. This creates singularities which apparently are relevant. So Sansikli has discovered these diagrams, which is very impressive, for the swimming two loops, and the planar diagrams, also made of backscattering. Here is a Cooper, it's a Cooper channel, so the backscattering is playing a role here. So it's the same story. The backscattering seems to be extremely relevant close to quantum critical point, and we don't know how to treat it. So there is an issue here. I claim this will be relevant in 3D as well, and Max, I discussed with him last week. He said he didn't check. So it's something we should check on Monday when he comes back. So far, the work has been done in 2D, but my claim is it will be also in 3D. But this is to check. So, okay, before I do that, so you see we are in trouble now. If this is valid as well in 3D, basically all the QCPs that we were relying on are open wounds, open problems for us, and we need help on all fronts. So I just want to make a little bit of an advertisement for work I did with Konstantin Yefetov and his student Hendrik Meyer, and I want to advertise this guy was a truly exceptional PhD student. So for all of you who want to hire super good postdoc in a year and a half to come, he's really at the heart of this calculation that we made, and I mean, I cannot say, he's not mine, he's a student of Konstantin, so I can't even say more. I mean, he's really completely exceptional. Okay, so we have a new bosonization which called supersymmetric, which is valid in high dimension. So bosonization is cheating a little bit because we don't transform fermions into bosons, but we recast exactly the theory from a theory of interacting fermions into a theory of marginally interacting bosons. Bosonic superfield. So we use a trick called Bikir-Westora, BRST. So it's something new. The idea was to re-exponential equation of motion. But the nice trick is to transform your Fermionic theory into upside to the fourth bosonic theory, on which you can do many things. You can do RG. We also claim on the side that it could help for the Monte Carlo signed fermion problem. But this is very, very disputed by the community of people who know the numerics better than us. I just want to make a bit of publicity because we already have a very nice result. We succeed to resolve all the backscattering processes for the family quick theory of Landau family quick theory, leading to resummation of all the non-elasticities of the family quick theory and the decoupling constant into charge and spin. This is a big work. Just heavy.
So what are the gammas and what are the
gamma, sorry, this is big gamma, this small gamma, but it's the same. So in family quick theory, you can usually couple into spin and charge channel with a bit of simplification over the family surface. And it was believed, like in the Landau family quick theory, that spin and charge channel are decoupled. Now, when you put the curvature, and it's something we know in 1D, there's the same idea, in 2 or 3D, it was believed by perturbation theory that the spin and charge channel get entangled again. So the spin sector will add on the charge sector, and the charge sector will add on the spin sector. We saw already for all the other QCPs that the curvature was playing a role, which is absolutely non-negligible, I mean, in all the control of QCPs. But as soon as you go to some non-elasticities, or if you deal with backscattering, because it's what we are dealing with here, it's basically a resummation of all the backscattering processes in family quid, you will couple spin and charge channel. And what we found with this new approach is the right variables to decouple them was some kind of singlet and triplet channel. So, I mean, you have a rotation, so you know charge and spin now are. So gamma 1 and gamma 2 are completely independent. And gamma 1 is a singlet, and this is a triplet channel, if you think in terms of Cooper channel. So, yeah, so we believe that that we've shown that all the non-elasticities of family quick theory can be decoupled into this one and two channels, singlet and triplet, and this is a beautiful form to take. So you see in the synthetic limit, L, I didn't say what is L, L is logarithm of lambda over T. So, and it's logarithm of lambda over T. So, asymptotically, you see a log square, a log log square of a log square. It goes to zero, but it's really non-analytic.
So, output
is
this
one? Sorry?
R output,
the
argument is gamma 1, for example.
Gamma 1?
Gamma 1. Yeah, that's what you hear.
Oh, sorry. This is our notation for the curvature, sorry. Put a zero here. Zero, I just took it from, sorry, I just took it from the. I should have used a small gamma here. But you see something really nice is the universality of it. When this term is bigger, this term dominates asymptotically. You don't see the gamma anymore, so you will just get a prefactor which depends on the velocity of the Fermi surface, but not on the coupling constant. So that's so in the Landau family quick theory, they are not dominant, they are subdominant, but they are universal and non-analytic. So I must say it's the first time there is some in a controlled way. So we have 5 minutes to go to stronger coupling. So here I will review mainly what Santil told you in his talk last week. So it will be basically the same message. I don't have disagreements. And I start with their paper, so Santil Sachdev-Voita in 2003. So we were a few to have these kind of ideas before, but this paper was seminal because they proposed a model on which we could describe this type of phase transition. And it's a phase transition between what they call FL star and FL. And the key ingredient here is the Fermi surface volume was changing in a drastic way at the transition. You were losing a huge part of Fermi surface. Usually, if you do an antiform magnet, you will just open a gap at the hot spot and you will reconfigure the Fermi surface by doubling the brilliant zone. But because you have the change of symmetry on the lattice, that's what you have. But here you will lose the fermions, part of the Fermi surface. So on this side, you have a cold Fermi surface here. And when you reach that quantum critical point, the particles which are localized, I said the fermions which are on the lattice of the, which are localized on the lattice, they become hot, namely their lifetime goes to zero, so they die. And when you reach the other side here, the Fermi surface is kind of virtually present, it's not really there anymore. You could maybe access it through excitations, but certainly not true of the Hassan Alfen experiment. So you lose part of time surface at the quantum critical point, and the Littinger counts of the quasiparticle should vary drastically from one that side to this side. So again, I go back to the chemistry. And what is really good to have in mind for those compounds always is entropy ideas. So suppose we have already screened with all the lattice effect, and we are now at the Kondo impurity temperature and we want to go down. We have different possibilities. We can Kondo screen. We could form a spin liquid. What those guys affected, so like the big spin around the impurities which are creating the entropy, carrying the entropy, could get entangled one with each other and reduce the entropy that way. We could form Cooper pairs or infrarotic singlet. And there was a thorough study, so lots of people don't like it, I like it, by a Fisk group, Los Alamos, with David Pines. And young Chinese guy, Li Feng Yang. So they classify a huge number of heavy thermal compounds, and they ask themselves, if you are below the Kondo temperature, what is bigger? Is it the RKKY temperature, or is it the heavy thermal liquid temperature? And to the surprise of mostly everybody, they found that the RKKY temperature was above for most of the compounds. So here you have local moments, and here they kind of screen into the soup. So they call it Kondo liquid, I would call it spin liquid, due to the magnetic interaction between the local moments. And here you have a temperature which would correspond to the screening of the local moments by the conduction electrons. So it seems that for most of the compound, the spin liquid is a real possibility. And the idea, actually one of the main inputs that we got from Subir and Santil and Matthias Voita, is that this Kondo breakdown quantum critical point, we can call it here, where the Fermi surface collapse from one side to another, is always associated, at least in the theories that we have, with the emergence of a spin liquid. And I think what they call Kondo liquid here, I mean, they didn't know about that, I think. They did independently their studies. So this, again, is controversial. I told you why I believe in it, because Zach is really a champion of those. I mean, he's kind of an alchemist of our age, so he knows all these compounds by heart. He kind of dreams of them at night. It's really something. And they classified, I don't have the paper there, but really a lot of them. So, at some point, I mean, you have to trust the expert. So, the scenario that advocate is a very close analogy with the cuprate. And I just will very quickly here show you. It could be interpreted into a mode transition. So, it is a point where the F electrons delocalize. So, what they call the selective mode transitions. So the conduction electrons, they don't localize, so they kind of separate from the F electrons which localize. So in the cuprate, you have only one type, and you get a mode transition where this type localizes, you get a spin liquid. Here you have a bit of the same story, but at function of the hybridization. Again, you have a competition between kinetic energy and potential energy. In heavy Fermi, you have much more kinetic energy because you have a hybridization to a bath. The conduction electron, they form a bath, and you hybridize your system of Lagrange impurity to the bath. So effectively, the hybridization has come effectively to zero. I mean, to the point where here the number, at least on one bond, number of F electrons is equal to one. So it's now what the idea is kind of a big tent, what I call a big tent for heavy fermions. A lot of people have participated to this idea, and I'd just like to mention my work with Mike and Norman and Indranil Paul. So we could call the selective mode transition. Our input was to say that there is a Z-control regime of fluctuations which is associated to this transition. And Z-control-3 is something which is very interesting around the antiform magnet. It could explain a lot of exponents. So I will not detail that, but if you're interested, you can ask me questions. So this is a diagram which is widely, I would say that among the theoreticians working in this field, it's probably is kind of accepted, except maybe for the present spinequid here. So at high temperature, you first heat the spin liquid, and then you would quench the entropy through residual orders, like here an antiformative order. But the whole idea is you are close to a point where the f electrons they want to localize. So that's the whole idea. It's kind of non. I don't say it's very. It's. It doesn't shock very much the committee of experimentalists because they know for a very long time that the F electrons, sometimes they are localized, sometimes they are not localized, depending on the compound. So all these heavy fermions, they are almost all in the brink of localization. So here is what we call the localized line. So it's localized on the left, and it's around on the right. And every theorist has his own way to put the compound on this diagram. So that's my way. For example, I would put cerium, copper, 6 gold here, exactly at the antiferromagnetism and far away from the localization line. I would put ytterbium, rhodium, silicon exactly by chance at the line where the antiferromagnetism and loci line get here. I would even put this one, which is another weird beast, not far away from localization. So I think it's widely admitted that there is something doing with the fact that the F electrons they reduce their mobility tremendously along some phase diagrams, and that it could affect the transport. I believe it's a main idea. So now I will defend my point of view here, which is maybe a bit different from what Santil presented you last week. So I believe that the main idea, the basic idea that they had, Santil, Sajdev, Vojta, and that a few had before, that of the localization of F electron is good enough. And that the fact that in some compounds, antiferromagnetism ends up exactly at the same point where the localization forms is an accident. So it's my belief. It's like some compounds are fine-tuned. And so this is the compound we're talking about, ytterbium, rhodium, silicon. And for the pure compound, it's typically the fact that you see. So the T-star line is the line that we think is associated to localization. We see it emerging in the study of the whole conductivity of all the magnetoelectric effects, basically, and also of the Grunheisen, Mankiw-Grunheisen ratio and Grunheisen ratio. So there is a line of T-star which determines the property of the systems are different on the two sides, and we attribute it with the localization line. And on top of it, you have a line which is a Fermi liquid on which you observe the T-square resistivity and the specific heat, and which is different. And so here what is interesting is when they dope this compound with cobalt or with iridium, it's possible apparently to separate the two lines. So you have here TN, so when we dope with cobalt, you increase the antiferromagnetic temperature. So Tn is going to zero here, and actually you see the width of the Earth-Milis theory is very small. And reciprocally, you can remove the antiferromagnet completely and still get linear resistivity up into very small temperature. You still have a little bit of T square, but then you have a strong regime with 3 decades of linear resistivity. And here you still see a T star line. You don't see a T square. I mean, this is very small T square. So I thought it was enough proof, but when I heard Santil last week, I heard that it's controversial, so I should probably inquire in the Dresden group. It's a long time I didn't discuss with them. What's going on then? I mean, for me, this was good enough to prove the case. It was finished after that. But so another theory of compounds, those are the gold mine of Salamos, cerium cobaltinium 5, is called 115. So the cobalt is here, the rhodium is in the middle, and the iridium there. You have two superconductivity phase and the rhodium phase. Gosh, I think I'm already late, so I will just deliver the message here. So we have lots of anomalous exponential resistivity.
Yeah, it will take 5 minutes.
Yeah, well, it depends whether you, okay. Like, it will be a few experiments then, and that's it. That's it, it's a few illustrations of the table. So there's evidence in this compound for localization very close to where the rhodium is. And one of evidence is if you have the rhodium and you dope with tin and cadmium. So if you dope it with tin and cadmium, so the doping is kind of the best game of experimentalists, like it's a big game. So you dope with here tin and cadmium, and it's very interesting. You create anti-ferromagnetic phase when you dope with cadmium. And what's more interesting, they do NMR on it, and they're able to see that the magnetism is localized. When with NMR, they're exactly able to see where is the magnetic moment, and the magnetic moment is attached to the cadmium that you doped with. So here the magnetism is localized, and it's very, very close to the type of diagram you see for the real compound under pressure. Here you have the doping with tin, and it generates a full region with linear temperature resistivity that you can see, but you cannot see because I didn't show it. Ah, yeah, you can see it here. Now you have two decades roughly for this one with beautiful linear resistivity. And if you take the rhodium compounds, you even have a regime where resistivity is sublinear for 1.5 decades, which is even weirder than the linear one, result of 0.4 by Paglioni. And it's very anisotropic, this one. So the cobalt will show actually 32/3. So I think the idea is T linear in the C direction and C2/3 in the AB direction. No, it's the opposite. Sorry, guys. It's the opposite. No, it's right. G perpendicular and H parallel to C. It's right. This compound also shows the strong evidence for randomization of the Fermi surface. So whether it's at the transition or not, it's the evidence that Santilli gave. So look, here you have, it's a study under pressure, hydrostatic pressure now. It's a rhodium case under pressure, and you see something happens here, which is very reminiscent to what Gil Lanzarich talked to us in the talk with uranium, germanium 2, except that for Gil, it was a ferromagnet, and here we have an antiferromagnet and a super big superconductivity transition. But they have absolutely no clue what the antiferromagnet does in the middle. Here they didn't see any sign of coexistence as far as I know. But what they see is this. So they do the Hasman Alphen. And if you went to the talk of Andy McKenzie, he really stressed the point that the Hasman Alphen was really the king of experiments to see the Fermi surface effects. And you see that at this critical pressure, and you see where the critical pressure afterwards, they show a very strong economization of the mass, which indicates second order phase transition, and at the same time, a very abrupt change in the volume. You lose completely some bands, and then you just recreate the bands from all the way. Now, this happens at the critical pressure, which is a dome, the upper, the dome of the superconducting temperature. So whether it's exactly at the point where the antiferromagnet goes to zero, whether the antiferromagnet goes to zero or not, is not clear. So this is something I wanted to show because we talked about it. This is the band theory for the cerium cobalt, for the cobalt case, and this is the one for the rhodium. So for the rhodium, they replace the cerium by the lanthanum. It means that they can describe the band theory of this system by a completely localized and inert atom of lanthanum. It has absolutely no F electron. So it is a right band theory. So they believe the cerium rhodium is localized, while the cobalt is itinerant. So you see it can be 2D, I don't know who asked the question. When we call 2D, it's typically this case. So is it really 2D? It's kind of looking cylindrical, but there's 3D corrugations in the system. a few bands, but some of them are really 2D character for sure. So this is typical of studies of band theory for heavy fermions. This is really typical. You know, on most of the compounds, you will just have an itinerant theory, but on some of them, you describe much better what's going on in the system if you replace the big atom by its inert partner, which is supposed to be a localized proof of locality. And this is just a transparency to show you that in those systems, usually we have lots of popping up energy scales around the QCP, like a T-square, for example. This is the infamous ytterbium rhodium silicon of the Dresden group. And the Grenoble group, they wanted to play dirty with them. So what they did is they cleaned the compound a lot. And when they clean the compound, they see that the T-star line, the Fermi liquid line, it goes doesn't go to zero. And they saw a little bit of T-square at this scale. So of course, and it was a hot debate, the Dresden group said it was not right. But in any case, if you give to another group, they will find you up, it goes almost, it's right, but it doesn't go up to zero. So they will find you energy scale. So it's very easy to find emerging energy scales in those compounds. That's the only point I want to make. Experimentally, it's really easy. And it's due to the fact that you have many electrons, at least two types or three types. So for the Fermi liquid, you have one energy scale, which is a Fermi liquid energy scale. Here you would have many others. It makes sense. I mean, so that's my conclusion. I think there is a very strong experimental evidence for anomalous quantum criticality in heavy fermion compounds, and there is a very strong breakdown of the conventional techniques, which integrate out the fermions. I believe that it's for all models below the equal tree, but I still make a reservation on one because I didn't check with Max. So if Max agrees, it will be for all. And the main emerging idea, for which we have a model which is still very badly controlled, is an idea of fractionalization, deconfinement, and with a spin liquid emerging at the QCP. So we desperately are in need for other methods and theories. Thank you.
I don't remember Santel mentioning this work. Could you ask him why?
Which work?
You mentioned this Santel test of Wojta,
the
surface changes.
Yeah.
But I think what I remember Santel said, I don't know how to describe this transition when you put up these.
Yeah, I didn't say it, but the theory for the stronger quantum critical point is even less controlled than it is for the standard Matthews theory. So I would agree with him. I mean, what we do is basically a treatment which is very inadequate with Willy Ashberg. They integrate out the fermions out of the partition function. In all the cases, we do a treatment which I find not satisfactory, and I think some people do that, yeah.
There was a second drawback of what they had done, the simple difference, which was that that transition is between an ordinary equals and exotic equals.
Yes.
The students seem to think that the terms are just on the sides, not the critical. But it is a spin of the
well, okay.
The
robustness of the exotic phase. Indeed, I believe less in the robustness of the exotic phase as Santil does. First, there is something on top of it, like antiformalism or spectrometry, which I think is able to at least hide it to our eyes. And theoretically, what it is due to is to some gauge fields. So all the gauge field fluctuations will affect the specific kit, much less the transport. But transport will affect it, but at very, very, very low temperature. But the specific kit will be affected, and we don't see that specific kit. I mean, we see logs in the specific kit, so I wouldn't say it's a discrimination for the theory. I see that the effect of the gauge fields are not necessarily very easy to observe in any case. But again, maybe some people disagree with that, I don't know. It seems like I believe more in this theory in general. I believe that the main idea is that you have two kind of fermions I think Subir said something of the kind when we discussed. I mean, we, like for example, the anomalous transport, I don't think you can get it for the system if you don't involve the lattice of F electrons. They will really play a role in the transport properties and the transport exponents or.
When you had a slide where you said you wrote some sort of scaling for what you called them, strong critical points or something, where you had a specific heat Sommerfeld coefficient going like T to the minus beta.
Yeah.
You wrote beta less than or equal to 1. I mean, yeah, well, they're mostly logs. Are there other examples where you actually have gamma diverging at temperature?
For gamma, I mean mostly logs.
Any cases where it's we actually have a power law?
Yeah, there is one case which is extremely controversial, which is the ytterbium rhodium silicon. Below 300 mK, it was observing a divergence with a factor 1 minus 1/3. Or slow, kind of slow divergence, but still not enough, much more than that. It was still not creating entropy at equal zero. But this paper is under debate.
The top two in your table had this property, right?
Yeah, because I mentioned this one for the second one, I don't know. But for this one, I mentioned this paper because I liked it very much. But even now, after a few years, it has never been reproduced, you know, this experiment and Mr. Crisot. So I would say the law.
That's the origin of the debate, is it's not very slow.
Yeah, kind of. Maybe it's kind of some kind of debate, no? Yeah, next one.
And what's the second one? It's just alpha, there's no number?
The second one, I think the second one is it's for the cobalt, you are close to the, it's even more debatable, you are close to the thermal transition, which is screening a lot of the properties. So basically you're right, it's log or log minus some kind of exponent. The most drastic divergence is basically transport. Like it's one frame, if you would say one frame for this compound, transport is very anomalous. Specific heat, kind of. And spin susceptibility, not that much. Even if you are close to an anti-four magnet, you get an anomalous exponent for the spin susceptibility, and the best candidate for it was some cobalt 6 gold. But apart from this one, the spin susceptibility is anomalous, but less than the transport would suggest. Well, I hope it was not. I mean, it was very a bit of clarity and not putting a lot of things in your mind. Okay, there's still a few things.